Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back to the show that actually provides the only solution forward. There are no other shows that will cover this, I hope. And that's not because they can't cover this. As a matter of fact, I was just recently on Connecting the Dots. There are other shows that do talk about this, but they're not focused on this. So if you're looking to understand, and so this is why we hope to be able to start growing this show into other people doing a very similar show and focusing on what's going on in their state. This is why it was in my vision to really have, you know, either a party leader, somebody that is ramrodding Republic Review and working at the grassroots level, working with the legislatures, working with the patriots of each state. It is my perspective that we should be having 50 different hosts on either a daily basis or at least a weekly basis of being able to provide us with what they're doing, what's coming up, and how things are moving, what are their obstacles, what do they need help with. That type of information is the critical information we need to start building, and we need to actually start getting that into this show. Eventually, when things really start moving, I will probably start, I don't want to say surrendering the show, but I'll start utilizing the show to actually allow people from the different red states, South Dakota, Missouri, what have you, in getting them 1 hour of the show so they can kind of talk about who's doing what we need, and how we need your help. Folks, if you're living in a blue state, nothing you can do in spending money or on the politics side, other than the education and damage control and those types of things, it is far more important that we get states calling for Republic Review immediately than it is for you to spend money in getting a guy to go to the state house or to the governorship or what have you. There are red states. This is the red states are where we need to focus. Tennessee is another state. North Dakota is another state. Montana is another state. Idaho, Utah. These are the states that we need to start focusing on in building Republic Review and the momentum for it so that we get the 13 and then the 27, so forth and so on. So welcome back to the show that never ends. Well, if you think about it, maintaining compliance is a lifelong vigilance. It's just like living the commandments. You know, you may live life, but if you're not living the commandments all your life, then you're failing. And the states, as well as we the people, need to hold our government accountable to the Constitution. It was cleanly and I'll say divinely inspired and instilled. And what we have to do is we have to actually get our public servants to understand it so that they can comply. Anyway, let me move forward because we ran out of time. I was just covering treason as Madison was, you know, talking about Burr and his case of treason, as it pointed to the fact that there was this validity of sovereignty, that the federal government or the national government, the general government, had a level of sovereignty that it could arrest and punish treason. In other words, a person who is actually violating the law of the land. So when I tell you, when you hear this little promo that we are obligated based on our birthright in supporting the Constitution, I'm not kidding. We have a requirement to support the law of the land to make sure that you and I remain free with our liberties to do those things that we believe is best for us. This is the footstool of the world for liberty, as I've said. Anyway, don't forget Red Pill Expo, Lafayette, Louisiana. Don't forget, if you're looking for furniture, Timber Nation. And don't forget, we have a comment line, 425-270-5416. What I want to do is I kind of want to look in my rearview mirror and see the notes on nullification done. We just, like I said, we just wrapped up with page 11, and I'm going to just kind of finish the last part that we kind of hurriedly went through and couldn't talk more about. And again, this is James Madison, paragraph 87, about halfway through. So familiar is the sovereignty in the United States to the thoughts, views, and opinions, even of this polemic adversaries that Mr. Rowan, in his elaborate speech in support of the indivisibility of sovereignty, relapsed before the conclusion of his argument into the idea that sovereignty was partly in the Union, partly in the states. See his speech in the Richmond Inquirer. Other champions of the rights of the states, among them Mr. Jay, and that's probably Mr. Jefferson, might be appealed to as bearing testimony to the sovereignty of the U.S. If Burr, now we're talking about the infamous Burr who killed Hamilton, who was charged for treason, but they couldn't get a conviction, and that had more to do with John Marshall than it had anything to do with Burr committing treason. If Burr had been convicted of acts defined to be treason, which is allowed to be committed only against a sovereign authority who would then have pleaded the want of sovereignty in the United States, and I don't know what the QER means. QUER is an acronym. But if there be no sovereignty in the United States, whether the crimes denominated treason might not be committed without falling into the jurisdiction of the states and consequently with impunity. In other words, the reason treason was granted full jurisdiction over the United States was the fact that because you could commit treason against your state, and the state could, and they do have jurisdiction over those things. But treason against the United States in the Constitution, it clearly states that the United States has jurisdiction over those forms of treason. The whole point is that it is not a state or it's not a sovereignty if it can't defend itself from, you know, bad players like Burr. Therefore, he's just using this point of treason to point out that if the national government wasn't a sovereign, then they wouldn't have granted and the states would not have given them the jurisdiction over treason or crimes committed against it. So moving on, 88. What seems to be an obvious and indefensible proof that the people of the individual states, as composing the United States, must possess a sovereignty, at least in relation to foreign sovereigns, is in that supposition only. Foreign sovereigns would be willing or expected to maintain international relationships with the United States. Let it be understood that the government of Washington was not a national government respecting a sovereign authority, and that the sovereignty resided absolutely and exclusively in the several states as the only sovereigns and nations in our political system, and the diplomatic functionaries at the seat of the federal government would only be obligated to close their communications with the Secretary of State and with new commissions repair to Columbia in South Carolina and other seats of the state governments. They could no longer, as representatives of a sovereign authority, hold intercourse with functionary who was but an agent of a self-called government, which was itself but an agent representing no sovereignty authority, not that of the United States as separate sovereignties, nor a sovereignty in the United States. For a like reason, the plenipotentiaries of the United States at foreign courts would be obliged to return home unless commissioned by the individual states with respect to foreign nations. The Confederacy, quote unquote, of the states was held de facto to be a nation, or other nations would not have held national relations with it. So he's kind of pointing out that when it really comes down to compacts, treaties with foreign states, and this is clearly in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, where the state can't sign and can't create treaties with foreign nations. Now, they can have some agreements, like, you know, trade and, you know, like if you have a roadway or what have you, but the federal government has jurisdiction over who enters and what crosses those lines. That's clearly in the Constitution. States do have the ability to have direct intercourse, as he calls it, or direct relations with the foreign nations south of them or north of them, such as Canada and Mexico. However, when it really comes to making agreements whether it be for trade, immigration, and those things, it requires engagement, full engagement with the federal government, because the federal government has full jurisdiction over immigration and has full jurisdiction over the importing and exporting of goods into the states. So as he starts pointing out that in the, and I think what he's pointing to is this paradigm that shifted when the United States was created, because the federal government may have had, I should say, the federal government under the Articles of Confederation, the Continental Congress, may have had the ability to make trade and treaties or actually create debt, but so did the states. Each state had the ability to create its own compact and treaties. That was a huge shift from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution. In other words, we created in this Constitution this ring of protection or this buffer that all things regarding trade, immigration, and those types of agreements, and it goes down to the fact that only those types of agreements can the United States sign, because they were also constrained in the ratification debates as it was defined that the federal government could not make a trade or treaty regarding specific types of things such as the environment, the Paris Accord. That's not an enumerated power. The federal government has no enumerated power over the environment, regulating and managing the environment. The states never delegated that power to them, so they can't go into a treaty over anything of that issue, nor can they go into a treaty of things that they're constrained from, like Second Amendment rights and those types of things. Anyway, we'll be right back, and we're going into paragraph 89. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me kind of provide some clarity, because I actually got a question, and literally just got a question on this, that talks about the sovereignty of the United States and the sovereignty of the states. See, the sovereignty of the states are sovereigns and equal sovereigns amongst each other. However, there are barriers to the states that are a part of this union, because this union had delegated very specific powers to the federal government over trade. So here's the question that was asked. Prior to Rhode Island and I think North Carolina joining the union, and whatever state may have been out there prior to, and I think it was just those two. I'm pretty sure it was just those two. I can't remember, because it's that
that age thing that catches up with me. So I have to actually look it up and go, okay, now I remember. But prior to those states becoming a part of the Union, Rhode Island and North Carolina could not engage in direct commerce. Now, North Island really posed a real problem. Now, they ratified the Constitution before the end of the first session, but how did South Carolina and how did Georgia actually move commerce from their states into the other states? Did they have to use ship, or did they use the travel by land, the roadways or the highways? And back then, folks, it was dirt. It was wagons and that type of thing. And so to quickly move commerce, a lot of commerce from one point to another, it was far better and more efficient to use a ship. Because going from Savannah, Georgia, all the way up to New York, you could get there faster than going via a buggy or what have you. And the buggies, they didn't have semi-trailers. You got to look at the technology and how difficult life was back in those days and how easy we have it. So North Carolina, as a sovereignty not in the Union, they could easily have become an economic hostile agency or state to the United States had they wanted to create tariffs and so forth with, you know, with all of the states, or actually they would be creating tariffs against the United States, because any type of commerce or trade that they had to commit actually had to go through the United States in those agreements and or in those trade efforts. They couldn't just go to South Carolina and say, hey, you know, we'll make an alliance and we'll ship you these goods and we'll buy these goods from you. They couldn't do that. They had to go through the United States or through the Department of State, the Department of Treasury. And I believe all importing and exporting fell under the Treasury, which was wrong. It should have actually fell under the State Department, because the State Department should be the one that monitors the relations with foreign states. The Treasury was just the tax gatherers. So the reason why the Treasury had such a superior role is because of timing. Hamilton was present when the cabinet was formed. Jefferson was months away from actually being seated on the cabinet. And so when Washington formed his cabinet and got Hamilton into the room, Hamilton said, well, I'm going to help you out, President Washington, and I'm going to delineate how each of these departments need to be broken down. And he aggrandized the Treasury Department over the State Department. So when Jefferson got there, he was absolutely pissed off. When he looked at, hey, clearly this is a State Department function. This is a State Department responsibility based on the Constitution, and you moved it over underneath the Treasury Department by implication. And this is where Hamilton and his implied powers and implications of those types of things, as a forked tongue lawyer, he got away with convincing Washington to support his premises. And from that point forward, it was very difficult to realign the powers, because Jefferson kept on fighting. Jefferson ultimately ended up walking away from Washington's administration, and so did other people, but Hamilton hung it out. And so it was that type of behavior between Washington and Jefferson that strained that relationship, because Washington, he wanted them to get along. He didn't see why it was so important whether one department did this or not. He thought it was ego or what have you, instead of actually understanding that certain functions need to be done. You don't split up functions. You don't create, you know, war agreements and trade agreements by two separate bodies. You use the same avenues of communications, because all you're doing is you're dividing your communications and creating more confusion and or allowing manipulation and confusion to be injected into your relationships, or your, I'll call them the ambassador and or, well, there's another word for it, and it escapes me, obviously, but in those, actually, it is international, it's your international accords, relationships, and those types of things, that when a state, you know, aligns with another state, why would you have two separate channels of communication? You should only have one. Anyway, Anywho, back to where we are with the notes on nullification. He's clearly pointing out that in creating this federal government, and as we can tell, these last few pages, he's going down some details that, you know, kind of actually help a little bit understanding sovereignty and American republicanism. He doesn't call it that, but he does point out the levels of sovereignty are integral in this system. And once you understand that and acknowledge that, then it makes it a little bit easier to understand bicameral legislative bodies and why they need to be divided from the sovereignties and have true sovereignty representation. Hopefully, this starts waking people up of restoring the Senate to becoming the representation for the sub-element of government within that government. Like at the state level, the sub-element of government is the county or the parish in Louisiana. It's parishes. So they should be the ones that would be having representation in the Senate, not the people. If it's all about the people, then we only need one body of representation, not two. And so all they've done in creating two bodies, this is one of the reasons why I believe it was Nebraska that got rid of their House of Representatives. They just now have senators because the senators only represent the people, and they realize we don't need to make government bigger. You know, if it's now just about the people, then okay. But they never changed the Constitution in the responsibilities of representation of state. They only changed the process of how senators were to be appointed. They would be appointed by election instead of appointed by selection from the legislature. There's a big difference. And they're still supposed to be looking after the issues and concerns for the state. They're still supposed to be responsible to, but this is how it perverted that. This is how the Senate has become perverted, and how we've been moved towards more of a representative of the people. And this is all an incremental shift towards democracy and mob rule. Moving on, paragraph 89. The more of the political system of the United States is fairly examined, the more necessary it will be found to abandon the abstract and technical modes of expounding and designating its character, and to view it as laid down in the charter which constitutes it. The Constitution is what he's talking about. Every once in a while, he'll refer to the Constitution as the compact. A lot of times, that's what he does. Every once in a while, he'll actually refer to the Constitution as a charter, which constitutes it as a system hitherto without a model, as neither a simple or consolidated government, nor a government altogether confederate, and therefore not be so explained as to make it either, but to be explained and designated according to the actual division and distribution of political power on the face of the instrument. So, just so you understand, if you've ever heard me say hybrid constitutional republic, that is the most accurate depiction of our Constitution and political system, because we have multiple constitutions, and at the federal government, we have not just a federal, we have a confederacy, because the states being sovereign, they have the sovereignty over everything that the federal government does not have sovereignty over. Healthcare, all the trade amongst themselves. The federal government did not dictate what can be traded and those types of things between the states. Their only role is to ensure that the states play together nicely and fairly, and not try to take advantage and create cabals and those types of things. So clearly, as we go through this, and as we just went through this one paragraph, he actually talks about it's not a simple or consolidated or altogether confederate. And so this is why when you look at our constitutional republic, it is a hybrid. It has some sovereignty that is delegated at the federal level or the national level or the international level. In other words, the outward facing sovereignty is the general government. The states themselves, they are the sovereigns over all of the rest of the things in protecting. There's the sovereigns in relationship between the states. They're also sovereigns in relationship between them and the general government. And they are to be protecting the interest of the sub-elements of government and the people thereof.
Because, as a matter of fact, as we understood, and the sovereign citizen movement kind of points out, that you're a citizen of the state, you're not only a citizen of the state, you're a citizen of the county. Because when you move into that county, you become a stakeholder in that county, you start paying taxes. You pay the property taxes and those types of things. Now, can a state, I'm going to go down this really quick tangent, can a state actually have licenses for driving? Can they create those types of things? Can counties actually have yes. Are they denied this in the U.S. Constitution? People say they can't constitutionally do it, but absolutely not. All powers not granted or delegated to the national government are reserved to the states and the people. So that means the states and counties have other avenues of taxation and so forth. Anyway, we'll be right back, and we'll hopefully wrap up either in this next segment. We will be done by the end of the show with these notes, and we'll come to a conclusion. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so right back into, because as we were going into the break, I said we'll come to the conclusion. We'll at the end of this, we will get and basically deliver the conclusion that I've been telling you. It is, as far as I'm concerned, as obvious as the nose on my face, is that what we have here is clearly the only path in getting federal government overreach back into check without destroying our Constitution. And as he points out, well, I'll wait till the conclusion when we get to that point. There is one view of the subject which ought to have its influence on those who espouse doctrines which strike at the authoritative origin and efficacious operation of the government of the United States. The government of the United States, like all governments, free in their principles, rests on a compact not between the government and parties who formed it and live under it, but among the parties themselves. And the strongest of governments are those in which the compacts were most fairly formed and most faithfully executed. And you got to highlight that part, right? Most fairly formed and most faithfully executed. Now, all must agree that the compact in the case of the United States was duly formed and by a competent authority. It was formed, in fact, by the people of the several states in their highest sovereignty, which is what? As people? No. As states. That's why they created a convention of delegates representing the people in the ratification, not their current government. And This in itself proves that they knew and understood at the Constitutional Convention, and enough people understood that they were jerking the power away from the problem, the states themselves, these state governments, these cabals. And so they wanted to make sure that the people had an opportunity to actually bring in and select somebody else other than those people that were sitting in the state houses. And I think that was one of the few contributions that maybe the Federalist Papers might have made, but they didn't spell it out. Hey, please make sure when you vote for your delegate to go to the convention that it not be the same political party that's sitting there right now that's a part of the problem. Get fresh views on this so that you can actually look at this opportunity that we're providing you before we actually watch the Confederacy and the Articles of Confederacy crumble and the fall of America. Because that was the direction the nation was going had the Constitution not been written and ratified. Anyway, an authority which could have made the compact a mere league or a consolidation of all entirely into one community. Such was the authority if such had been their will. It was their will to prefer to either the constitutional government now existing, and this being undeniably established by a competent and even the highest human authority, it follows that the obligation to give it all the effects to which any government could be entitled, whatever the mode of its formation, is equally undeniable. It had been formed by the people of the United States as one society, and if that's what happened, we created a single society of sovereignty underneath this limited powered government. The authority could not have been more competent than that which did form it, nor would a consolidation of the people of the states into one people be different in validity or operation if made by the aggregate, in other words, you know, by the body or the whole, the aggregate authority of the people of the states, then if made by the plenary sanction, if given concurrently, as it was their highest sovereign capacity, the government, whatever it would be resulting from either of these processes, would rest on an authority equally competent and be equally obligatory and operative on those over whom it was established, nor would it be in any respect less responsible theoretically and practically to the constituent body in the one hypothesis than in the other, or less subject in extreme cases to be resisted and overthrown. The faith pledged in the compact being the vital principle of all free governments, that is the true test by which the political right and wrong are to be decided, and the resort to physical force justified, whether applied to the enforcement or the subversion of political power. Whatever be the mode in which the essential authority established the Constitution, the structure of this, the powers of this, the rules of exposition, the means of execution, must be the same. The tendency to consolidate, and as I don't know what the word is, or consolidation or dissolution, because the following word kind of gives you a hint because of how it's acronymed. But anyway, the tendency of to consolidation or dissolution, the same. The question whether we the people means the people in their aggregate capacity acting by a numerical majority of the whole or by a majority in each of the states. The authority being equally valid and binding, but a particular fact, the question is merely speculative whether the centripetal or centrifugal tendencies be greatest is a problem which experience is to decide and depends on the mode. The only distinctive is the effect of. And so it's nice that he actually used those two terms, centripetal and centrifugal tendencies, because in government and political powers, if you look at the two differences, a centripetal political power is pulling towards the center, is centralizing the power to one point. A centrifugal political power is one that is sending out or distributing the most of the power outward,
centripetal, pulling all the power inward, centrifugal, sending most of the power outward. That being clear, then when you look, and this is why Jefferson, and I actually use these terms and never realized that Madison used these terms, but I use these in my first book because I didn't even know that they were even common knowledge back then. I guess they were because there was basic energies and so forth, and Newton had been around for a while, but nevertheless, I'd never heard these words, terms used, thought I was the first one to do it. That being said, it is a correct, and it's the best analogy in helping you understand, and this is why when Jefferson said we have a distributive system, that the government, the most of the power of the government is to be outward, that is supposed to be closest to the people. Where is that? Where is that? Is it at the state house? No. It is at your county seat. And if your county seat is, if your county is too big and your county seat is too far away, there's too many people in your county, then you need to divide that county down so that you, you know, have better access and better representation. Some cities like New York, I don't even know how counties exist under such giants, behemoths of cities. So what you have to start looking at is the types of flows of power in our system. And as you do that, you should start appreciating and embracing the concept of American republicanism as I am defining it for you, as Sherman defined it for them in the Constitutional Convention, that sovereignty requires representation if we are to have a true liberal society that embraces liberty and respects the rights of sovereigns. Because once you take away the rights of one sovereign, you will end up taking the rights away from other sovereigns. And this is why the centripetal concept of centralizing all political power, it moves it away from the people, it moves it away from the county, it moves it away from the state, and pulls it all into the national level. And before you know it, the federal government is going to start dictating how much water your toilet can flush, the types of lights you can use, and the types of every product that you are going to use in your life, they're going to start dictating. That moves us away from a free market system into a mercantile system, because now government is controlling the production and consumption of products. This is how far we've drifted, my friends. What's it going to take? Now, we're almost done. We got paragraph 93, and we are on page 13. We've got three more paragraphs to go, or actually, I should say two more. In conclusion, those who deny the possibility of a political system with a divided sovereignty like that of the United States must choose between a government purely consolidated and an association of governments purely federal. All, and that's basically what we have, is an association of governments. We have a confederacy, but we also have granted very specific powers that can only be exercised by that federal government. Now, they've taken on a lot more, and the states have allowed them to do that, but they have not allowed them to do that in the constitutional manner. And this is where, when you get the parents to start talking, go, hey, do we really want to let them continue? We have the power to pull this back. Let's do that before they actually destroy us, because the federal government is actually committing treason. The federal government and the political powers in the swamp and so forth, they have been working to destroy America, really driven by the Communist Party, the Chinese Communist Party, which is the Democratic Party, and the Republican Party. And when I say and the Republican Party, I mean the rhinos. There are good conservatives, but they're not enough. There is not enough to save the federal government or get the federal government to do the right thing, nor is there a mechanism in the Constitution for them to do that. Once they've crossed that line, they never go back. The only way to make them go back is to drag them back with the authority of the states. That's what Republic Review does. All republics, back to Madison's comments. Oh, well, we will finish these last two paragraphs when we come back in the final segment. But obviously, he's even wrapping it up himself. And so this last few pages, as he's been meandering and kind of talking and discussing, I think it's very helpful. You're actually hearing how he's describing the relationships and so forth, the sovereignty. I think this is good. It may not go into nullification per se, but we'll be right back.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so anyway, let me just kind of wrap up this because he's wrapping it up as well. And so all republics of the former character, ancient or modern, have been found inefficient for order and justice within and for security without. It means outside them, even though it's the same without, they was used in a different context. They have been either a prey to internal convulsions or to foreign invasions in like manner. And so when they talk about invasions, it's not just an invasion of a military force, an invasion of migration, which is what the Mohammedans have done throughout Europe for over a millennia. In like manner, all confederacies, ancient or modern, have been either dissolved by the inadequacy of their cohesion or, as in the modern examples, continue to be monuments of the frailties of such forms. Instructed by these minority reasons, by the failure of an experiment of their own, an experiment which, whilst it proved the frailty of mere federalism, proved also the frailties of republicanism without the control of a federal co-organization. The United States have adopted a modification of political power which aims at such a distribution of it as might avoid as well the evils of the consolidation as the defects of federation and obtain the advantages of both. Thus far, throughout a period of nearly half a century, the new and compound system has been successful beyond any of the forms of government, ancient or modern, with which it may be compared, having as yet disclosed no defects which do not admire remedies. Yeah, just be clear here. There have been several attempts for the federal government to, at this point in time, in 1834, there have been three attempts for them to create this unconstitutional power called the Department of Transportation. And Madison is saying, hey, we've been doing really good so far because we've behaved well. But it didn't take much longer because after Madison died, the Department of Home was created so that the federal government could start creating their own territories unconstitutionally within states and start managing state property, which is unconscionable and a violation of the Constitution. Madison would have quickly stood up against those types of things. However, it takes time for things to start moving and it takes time to actually start you know, making shifts and people's understandings and convincing people and hoodwinking them that you have the authority and power to do whatever it is you're doing. And that's what ended up happening. They had to wait until these men who understood died off. That's why it was 1849 when they started really crossing boundaries. Anyway, do not admit remedies compatible with its vital principles and characteristic features. It becomes all therefore who are friends of government based on free principles to reflect that by denying the possibility of a system partly federal and partly consolidated and who would convert ours into either wholly federal or wholly consolidated, in neither of which forms have individual rights, public order, and external safety been all duly maintained, they aim a deadly blow at the last hope of true liberty on the face of the earth. Wow. How about that? I mean, he's basically saying, because he's recognizing where we are, and he's basically saying what I'm doing and what many others are saying. We're looking at this consolidation, this movement towards communism, not as just a communistic state, but moving this state to be subjugated to the world by some communist government, a national or an international earthly communist government, one single government, one world order. It is enlightened votaries which perceives the necessity of such modification of power as will not only divide it between the whole parts, but provide for occurring questions as well between the whole and the parts as between the parts themselves. A political system which does not contain an effective provision for a peaceable decision of all controversies arising within itself would be a government in name only. Such a provision is obviously essential, and it is equally obvious that it cannot be either peaceable or effective by making either part an authoritative umpire. The final appeal in such cases must be to the authority of the whole, not to that of the parts separately and independently. Okay? So, just to be clear, What the John Birch Society, the 10th Amendment Center, some of these other eight people are calling for nullification, these organizations that are calling for secession, that does not fix it. It cannot fix it. It will actually frustrate it more. It will actually make it harder to fix it because we're losing. You got to understand, when a good solid conservative state steps out of the union, they no longer can contribute to the solution. We lose one of the parties that is going to be essential in forcing the solution. We cannot allow, well, I can't say that we cannot allow, but we have to beg and plead that they don't leave, that we need them if we're going to fix this, because if they step out, they will be engulfed, because once they step out, it's over for them. And they're just basically, you know, giving us a death nail. And I am telling you that the direction we are going with the international reset and the pulling in of government, single, you know, what's a good word for creating a monetary system that is a single monetary system, a world government, world monetary system, and world laws is going to happen. And it will it's more likely to happen and quickly happen if states start to secede, if states start to go down this, or if they allow chaos to be committed. In other words, they start nullifying and stop obeying and start going down. Because basically, when the sheep herder of the communist movement comes, he's going to gather all the sheep and he's going to use all the force necessary. Unless we take back this government and we actually create that barrier of protection and then start offering that protection to other states in the world and get rid of the UN and get rid of this ideology of globalism and communism. Anyway, this was the view taken of the subject whilst the Constitution was under the consideration of the people. See Federalist Papers. That's a little note there. Go see the Federalist Papers. It was this view of which dictated the clause declaring the Constitution and laws of the United States should be the supreme law of the land. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any of the states to the contrary
Notwithstanding, it was the same view with which specially prohibited certain powers and acts to the states, among them any laws violating the obligations of contracts, in which dictated the appellate provision to the judicial act passed by the first Congress under the Constitution. And that was the Judiciary Act of, I think, 1792 or 1790. And it may be confidently foretold that notwithstanding the clouds which a patriotic jealousy of other causes have at times thrown over the subject, it is the view which will be permanently taken of it, with a surprise hereafter that any other should ever have been contended for. You know, in other words, considering any other type of system, this is the... I wish he would have actually gone as far as to say that the system, this political system, this government, he did say it was the greatest on the face of the earth ever to have ever existed. Well, how did it get that way? Did it get that way by accident, or did it get that way by the hand of the divine hand of providence inspiring these men to unite and actually consider things that they never would have considered? American republicanism, respecting and identifying and embracing sovereignty at multiple levels and creating a singularity sovereignty for very limited purposes for this thing called this national government or the general government that is to represent them with the rest of the world. Now, I will tell you, there is no doubt in my mind that when you read this document, there is nowhere... There may be points in time that, you know, will fool you just like they fool me when you read a section where he's talking about nullification and these rights, that clearly have these rights. He is emphatically saying that you can't do this, especially when you consider the measures necessary and the magnitude and consequences if you go down the path of nullification and secession. And he clearly states that if you go down that path of nullification, you need to secede because the concept of union is being broken. We have to unite. I can't say it any more clearer, folks. And I hope that as we've gone through these Kentucky resolutions, Virginia resolutions, the report that Madison did on the Virginia resolution and his notes here, your only takeaway is that we are obligated to save this Constitution and save this Republic and save this Union. And we have to do it as a united Union. The only way we can do this is to put aside our differences as well as our self-interests. That is why I'm not trying to create an organization. I'm not trying to make money here. And that is antithetical to everybody I deal with. Because I mean, how do you support yourself? I'm just saying that the Lord has blessed me to this point. And there may become a point in time where I'll need more. But I can tell you, if you started giving me money, that money would be going to things that would move this cause, not buy, not pay for my car, not buy, well, it may actually support my travel. Those types of things, because if it actually helps me do things, then absolutely, that money will be used for that. But it will not be used for buying dog food or any personal things. My wife and I believe that if we're successful, we will be rewarded, that I'll be able to restore the money I've taken out of retirement to be able to do this. Because, my friends, if we don't do this, your retirement will be worthless. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. And we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org
and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.